once again to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar, and we're heading out west.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Nailed it. Yeah, we're in our covered wagons, and our partners have died of dysentery because we're covering both the Midwest, the Gold Rush, and the Oregon Trail, and the Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
It sucked back then.
Giving it, well, yeah, a little bit.
Life was hard.
Giving it the Oscar Sprint Profile Review, the old OSP. This is Mike, Mike, and Oscar. I'm co-host Mike One. This is co-host also Mike.
Also Mike here. I love the accents, the voices, as a linguistic pleasure. You know, if you like radio and podcasts, as
that
you
sounds
do.
Dirty.
It's a linguistic pleasure. Yeah. It's, yeah, almost. This really works, and the Coen brothers are known for it, kind of like the Kroll Show I mentioned in the weekly there. And
if you're a longtime listener, I have a love-hate relationship with these two gentlemen.
Great music, though, too.
Oh, great music, great visuals. They are phenomenal directors, but their symbolism gets me mad and angry sometimes, so we'll get into all that. But this one is the Netflix anthology, I guess?
Yeah, as anthology films go, this was a strong one, and we don't get a lot of these. Horror anthologies happen with the VHSs.
Sure.
Southbound was the other one I was trying to think of.
Still got to get that down. Yeah, it's something that you said was a good horror anthology, and you're right. We're going to the Old West for this anthology, and certainly not something we usually get. Not something that's usually given awards consideration on top of all that, but the Coen brothers are never ones to stick to one trail, so I guess that's a pun intended there. So they kind of spread their wings with a couple different stories. Stories coming forth for this one movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. If you've never been with us for an Oscar Sprint Profile before, what it is, an OSP is what we call it. We call the lead up to the Academy Awards the Oscar Sprint because all these movies are coming out at the same time and we try to cover as many of them as we can. We take would-be, should-be, and will-be Oscars contenders, run them through our OSP profile. What that includes is the first half is going to be a spoiler-free review. We give you a nice dance music breakdown, really futuristic stuff from the hottest new DJ. I made it. And the second half is always a spoiler-filled review, so if you have not seen The Ballad of Buster Scruggs yet, do not worry. The first half is all spoiler-free. We go to the production values, the breakdown, the performances, but we usually start, as we will this time, Mike's going to give us the cast and crew.
Yes, cast in terms of the crew, written and directed by the Coen brothers. Here is their filmography. Hail Caesar, Inside Llewyn Davis, True Grit, A Serious Man, Burn After Reading, No Country for Old Men, The Lady Killers, Intolerable Cruelty, The Man Who Wasn't There, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, The Big Lebowski, Fargo, Hudsucker Proxy, Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing, Raising Arizona, and Blood Simple. Can I run an auction?
I will now go through each of those titles saying whether I like them or not. Like, didn't see, didn't like, didn't... Oh, no, go ahead.
I seen them all. And I like most of them. They have a couple, you know, stinkers. Lady Killers was a stinker.
You're a Coen Brothers guy. Though.
I am a Coen Brothers guy.
So, gun to your head, which is your favorite?
It's Lebowski, but I also love Miller's Crossing a lot. And I really like Barton Fink as a kind of like a, you know, a mission statement for writers. I really like Raising Arizona as just a wackadoo movie.
Are you just going to repeat their whole filmography
Oh,
again?
Brother, where are, you started this. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou is an all-timer for me, too. So
okay.
I really like those movies.
Burn After Reading might be my favorite, just for the record.
I like these guys. The Coen brothers were nominated for Best Original Screenplay for 2016's Bridge of Spies, Adapted Screenplay, Picture and Director for 2011's True Grit, Picture and Original Screenplay for 2010's A Serious Man. They won three Oscars, Picture, Director, and Adapted Screenplay for No Country for Old Men, as well as a film editing nod for that movie.
Yeah, that retrospective's coming. Probably this upcoming Oscars offseason, we'll dive into that. The long-awaited grudge match of No Country for Old Men v. Mike 1. And I know, I've said it a billion times, I know once I go back into that movie, I'm going to like it.
I had a vicious anger against that movie when me and Willem Dafoe watched it.
You together. And your boy Dubs, yeah.
Me and Will William, yeah. I call him Will Yum.
Well, his friends do, sure.
And we didn't like it. I could see it on his face. He cannot hide.
It's either that he didn't like it or he's planning a child's murder, but whatever his face was telling one of those two things.
Anyway, I had to rewatch it a couple times, and then I liked it a little more. Anyway, adapted screenplay nom for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou in 2001. Two nominees for editing and best picture for 1997's Fargo, as well as a win for best original screenplay for that movie. So that is four Oscar wins in a total of 14 nominations, Michael.
Not a bad bad ratio if you can get it. They're obviously one of America's best screenwriting slash directing duos, I guess you would say.
Yeah, they're a good team, and I've listened to them talk about who's more the writer, who's more the director, who's more the producer, who's more the director, and it's fascinating how they mix that up. I forget, but they do they do kind of share the responsibilities. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs stars, I'm going to mispronounce that name all day because it's like when you say that title, the ballad, I'm B-word fat, but ballad, I'm Buster, and then the Scruggs is like the hardest word to say.
So what do you want to say instead, Scruggs?
The T? I just want to say Scruggs. Scruggs. I keep trying to say Scruggs.
The Ballad of Buster and Scruggs, the TV show. I can't do it all on my own.
What's the rocket? Gunshot through rocket the head. And Tubbs, is that...
What?
The dad jokes, they just spew out of my mouth uncontrollably. Oh, cut all that. Anyway, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs stars Coen Brothers regular Tim Blake Nelson as the title character. TBN is...
What a smile.
Yes, he is most known for O Brother, Where Art Thou, Leaves of Grass, and Minority Report. All right, I'm going to list off another big paragraph here. Buster Scruggs. Scruggs. Buster.
Let it be known, if he goes Scruggs at all this episode, you know he means Scruggs.
It's not going to work. So I'm going to just say Buster.
Yeah.
Buster also stars the disaster artist himself, James Franco, Widows and Taken's Liam Neeson, The Big Six, Zoe Kazan, 10 Things I Hate About You's David Krumholtz.
Get in the Wayback Machine.
Highlander and The Shawshank Redemption's Clancy Brown.
There can only be one.
In Bruges and Calvary's Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah, he was there.
Office Space and Get Out, Stephen Root.
Nice stapler.
Yeah. He's my favorite. Harry Potter series regular Harry Melling.
I don't have a one-liner.
Seven Psychopaths and Down by Law's Tom Waits.
I can't wait to cover his short because I have something big to say about him.
Big fan of him. Those are some bad teeth, but a lot of bad teeth in this movie for the record.
Well, it was the Old West. Their dental plans weren't really kicking in until
the next month.
Dental
plans were bad. The Witch's Tom Innocent. I never want to wake up to Tom Innocent's face when, like, James Franco wakes up to his face at one point.
Is that a worry that you have to...
From The Witch and right. this movie.
So just... But I'm saying, like, in your life, when
his
you wake up...
His wife might be a perfectly delightful person, and he might be a wonderful man. But when Franco wakes up to his face,
right.
it is horrifying.
Sure. Well, there you go, then. I guess that's one thing that you'll have to be on the lookout for from now on.
And the double V Vitch.
Tom Innocent just throwing
Tom
over
Innocent.
And... Good morning, sunshine.
Scary bedside manner. Cagney and Lacey's Tyne Daly. I had to mispronounce
you
that.
You went Tyne, really deep with some
Tyne Daly. Unforgiven, Saul Rubinick. Concussions, Matthew Willick. And Hoosier and Major League's Chelsea Ross. He is the trapper in that last scene. You were just asking me about him
yes.
in the pre-production from Hoosiers. He is the...
Who is he in Major League?
He's the old pitcher. He's like the knuckleballer.
Oh, all right. Don't remember.
Want me to go down there and beat the shit out of them? That's the quote I remember from Major League.
Fair enough.
Great quote. Story inception and production.
Surprise, you're in a Major League review now.
Story inception and production notes. They announced Buster in January 2017.
Just go the Sean Combs route and just call him B. Diddy now.
B.S.
B. Scriggy.
B. Scriggy, I can say that.
Yeah, there you go.
This was a collaboration with Annapurna Television meant to be a television series, and yet the Coen brothers kind of had this mapped out for 25 years. They had been working on these short stories for 25 years throughout their career. They wanted to do this, and eventually they did what they do best, and they structured it into a movie. So Netflix announces that they bought the thing in August because it's shaped up as a movie, essentially, and they would stream it worldwide.
Interesting. I wonder if this happens without Netflix. It sounds like it was a finished product. Netflix just bought the license, maybe?
Yeah, Annapurna Television in terms of the development. So the work is based on...
I would like to see who was second on that list, like who didn't get the bid when Netflix got the bid.
Who knows? Yeah. They do talk about the fact that they were happy to sell to Netflix because they're kind of upset with all the movie studios because they're only financing superhero projects and action franchises.
That's why I bring up the question. Yeah. Maybe Netflix was the only ones willing to give them an outlet, or maybe they weren't going to get enough from anyone else. I don't know, but I would have liked to see the bidding on that.
Yeah, Joel Coen said, I mean, he loved investing with Netflix in this one because, quote, it's pretty much the business of the studios now to just do the comics and the action franchises.
Yeah.
So Buster Scruggs was filmed partially in the Nebraska Panhandle.
So that's not a place.
They're out there on the plains with the prairie dogs. And casting calls went out to ordinary Nebraskans to appear as extras, so that adds another layer to it. They also filmed in New Mexico on location. You know, you got a lot of canyoning. I don't know if it's a Grand Canyon or not. It looked like it.
It looked very, well, first of all, it looked very Coen, the way they shot it. And second of all, it looked very familiar that you had seen these before. And like you have listed here, they're the same places that No Country for Old Men and True Grit were. They get a very True Gritty vibe from some of the shots in this one.
There is one of these stories based on a Jack London short story called Wild White Fang Rider. Otherwise, like I said, they've been writing these for 25 years. And those are my production notes. Michael, you have specs.
Yeah, here's some specs for The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, written and directed by the Coen brothers. Also, Mike told you this already. They deviate the norms by only allowing one name for the directing line and one name for the writing line. Like we told you before, there were established rules that say if you do these things as a team, then you count as one name. That's why both Coens have their names listed as the directors on this, as well as the screenplay by. It debuted August 31st, had its world debut at the Venice Film Festival this past year. It went live on Netflix just a couple of days ago, November 16th. Carter Burwell does the music, and Bruno Del Bonel did the cinematography. It's a 133-minute runtime, and it carries an R rating. Produced by Annapurna Pictures, Mike already told you that, distributed, of course, by Netflix, which, if you know by now, means we don't know what the budget was. Critical reception from this, fairly high, 7.4 IMDb rating right now on about 8,000 votes. Metascore carries a 79. That's best picture territory.
That's up there.
Rotten Tomatoes, 92% fresh on a 7.7 out of 10 average critic score. 74% audience score, which is still pretty high. 3.8 out of 5 average audience rating on 849 votes. So this one's hitting well. It's hitting both the audience and the critics. But again, it's a Coen Brothers movie, so you would expect pretty much nothing less unless it's No Country for Old Men and 2008's Mike 1. There's a couple awards festivals that it was nominated for and has a couple wins at. The Adelaide Film Festival, nominated for the International Feature Award, Best Feature, Ethan and Jill Coen there. Cambridge, nominee for the Golden Frog, main competition for Bruno Del Bonel. He again did the music on this. Venice Film Festival, it won Best Screenplay, given to Ethan and Jill Coen. It was a nominee for the Golden Lion. Now you got me doing it.
Golden Lion.
Nominee for the Golden Lion for Best Film. Ethan and Jill Coen coming up short there. Those are the awards that it has right now. So this one is, you're talking Golden Lion, that means it's going to make some headway. It doesn't necessarily mean it's absolutely correlated with an Academy Award nomination, but it at least made noise, so you think this one could be considered in the Academy's light a little favorably. We'll see how it plays out, and that's why we're giving it the OSB treatment. The plot premise reads as such, quote, an anthology film comprised of six stories, each dealing with a different aspect of life in the Old West.
Thanks, Coen Brothers. Appreciate that.
If the Coen Brothers ever met J.J. Abrams and Damon Lindelof, what happens?
They do not get along very well.
I tell you what, we won't know what happens. The ending would be a twist.
The endings, maybe Lindelof and Abrams would figure out more better endings. They'd look at how
that
I'm speaking today.
Meme from the History Channel with the guys like, aliens.
The alien is friendly. Shit goes down.
Yeah.
But they're great setup artists. Good God. That's why I'm worried about episode 9. Can I just say it? I'm worried.
It's a Hollywood hot take in waiting, but having seen some stuff about him retconning episode 8, I'm not happy about, but well, that's a different story for
another
time.
And that's the problem with his Star Treks too, the endings. His beginning, the Chris Hemsworth beginning of the first Star Trek ripped my heart in half.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal. The end of Into Darkness, is that the
yes.
second one? Awful!
I'm just not happy about people being so ready and willing to tear apart the chances Rian Johnson took. But again, this is a hot takes for a different day.
Damn it. This movie also a little bit of a weird ending today. So maybe
it had an ending, though. I appreciated the ending of this.
I like it too. So in terms of expectations, Michael, what were you thinking going into this?
To not be happy with it. To be honest,
oh, really?
Like I said, the Coen brothers, me and me, are very hit and miss.
Movie
Fargo.
Pleasantly surprised
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it did.
For once?
It really did. It really did. I did enjoy most of it. It's six short stories, like we said, six kind of anthologies, so I was expecting to maybe find value in one.
This makes me happy. I'm going to spend the rest of this podcast talking in this tone of voice. Because I'm tickled freaking pink.
I had a stroke. No, I was pleasantly surprised. So I was kind of a downer on this, which is not very film critically of me and very biased of me. But I have also just fresh wounds all over my body from Widows. So I was very jaded.
I got two brothers who usually do not like slow-moving Western, slow-moving dramas. Sure. Of any kind.
I would fall into that category as well.
They both talked to me recently about this movie and liking it. My brother Daniel, who notoriously hates movies like this, loved it.
I'm the same way. I also feel like the setup or the spacing, this is a rhyming sentence I'm about to say, but the spacing helped the pacing of this. Like the fact that it's an anthology setup really helped. It's not really slow.
Right.
You kind of get into it right away for necessity's sake.
You have to catch up with each one of these characters. The subtext is very rich.
Yes.
So the audience is chasing it a little bit.
Yes.
And that helps in a way, because even the slower scenes.
And so you're going to be chasing it regardless.
Yeah, and it's just dense in detail. I agree. That first watch for me really moved along. The rewatches are a little slower, especially two of the short stories. So I think if you're not focused in, if you're on your laptop.
If you're a millennial.
Well, yeah. I mean, this one's a weird movie to watch on your laptop, I guess I would say. If you're half watching it and half on your laptop, that's not a great one of those. But I really love 4 out of 6, and the first watch, I loved all 6.
Yeah, I would say that too. I like 4 out of 6 of them.
I am not an anthology guy typically. Like I said, just a couple that I've seen. Never mind. I'll just go out of my way not to see them. Like, I want a narrative through line for 2 hours. I want a novel that's 1,800 pages.
Way. I'm the same way. And I'm very anti-Westerns too. It's just not my forte. It never has been. So props to the Coen brothers. I guess you and me can talk again.
So, production values with an Oscar lens. We're going to work it in throughout here. Sound to sight this time, please, because the score and the original song, I enjoyed it. Does it mean I'm getting old that I'm liking folk music
this
now?
This was kind of a half musical. And you're very much on the record saying that you are not a musical guy.
I am not a musical guy. I like Westerns a little more, but musicals are not my forte at all.
So, I think, you're maturing. Is how you would end that. I think
I'm
you're
old.
Growing as a critic.
Way of saying old. But the original score, especially during like the prairie scenes, the wagon train.
Yes.
I was roused, Michael. I am rarely roused by a Netflix movie these days. I like these Netflix movies. They're entertaining.
Sure.
But this one was rousing.
All right. Good
and
to hear.
The original song, I remember my English teacher, freshman year English, played Oh Brother, Where Art Thou for us. And it was,
of course.
I just felt he was such
a
dork.
It's been a while since you referenced your schooling of music. Or movies, I mean.
And he was just like, I like a couple things on first day of class. He's like, I love American literature. I love Westerns. And I love football. Because he's my defensive coordinator, too, when
was
I was playing
you?
There. And I'm turning into this man. I'm turning into this man today.
Maybe it's like that the movie Thinner, where you said a wish sometime in his class. It's like, oh, I wish I was you, and now you're just slowly becoming
this
him.
Is full circle. Yeah. I'm becoming this man.
All right. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But yeah, the music in this was awesome.
That,
it was really, really catchy,
song,
really good.
Tim Blake Nelson singing it, Carter Burwell working the score.
And the on-the-noseness of the songs in the first, but the Ballad of Buster Scruggs short, or the anthology piece, whatever you want to call it, I thought was so clever, too, because it was so, like, it was almost mocking old-school Westerns.
And it adds so much to the scenes. Like, one of the songs actually mocks a character in the scene.
Right.
And the whole place is, like, on his side, and it makes such a difference to what happens next.
Yes, absolutely.
I really danced around spoilers there. We have When a Cowboy Trades His Spurs for Wings. That's a Willie Watson song. Like I said, the gal who got rattled, the prairie music was great. There's also a lot of old Irish folk favorites. The Unfortunate Lad, sung by Brendan Gleeson, Michael. Mm-hmm. That was also in 3 Billboards this past year, except Sam Rockwell kept saying Mao.
Okay.
That's the Mao song.
All right. Good to know.
When I was a walking Mao. He's in the car at the beginning. I didn't even understand why he was doing that. It's just such a weirdo. But the sound effects are really terrific too. They often linger for a while and they kind of reverberate. Another word I've just learned and really like to say lately. Reverberations of the sound effects, especially into the interludes with the book and the pages being flipped. We still hear what just happened.
As far as sound effects too, are the Coen brothers the best at portraying gunfire.
Oh yeah,
I mean they make it look so real, and it sounds so authentic anytime there's a shootout in all their movies, whether it's something taking place in the Old West or a shooting happening in a guy's closet.
Just think of the Tommy guns in Miller's Crossing. But you're right, in Burn After Reading, once they kind of slowed their pacing down, they went from the Lebowski fast pace to the Burn After Reading, obviously No Country Old Men. You know, they've been hit and miss with it. I thought Hail Caesar was a mess. This is more well paced. And
I agree.
Even though there's a few lapses, I really like this one. But you're right. The sound does a lot for that. I think working in a rousing score, even during the slow scenes.
Absolutely wonderful score.
So right now, in terms of Oscar lens, sound editing is 10th on award circuit. Original score, Carter Burwell, is 11th on award circuit.
Knocking on the top 10. That seems probably right.
Original song, When a Cowboy Trades His Spurs for Wings, is 10th on award circuit.
Unfortunately, it doesn't matter about original song anyway.
Yeah.
Everything's up against a monster, literally.
But these are puncher's chance kind of.
Sure. Knocking on the door. Yeah.
Our friends over there. Now, production design, costume design, makeup and hairstyling. Mike, my thesis statement here is that I felt like we're in Old West.
Yeah.
I felt like it looked really great. That
costume
bank.
Design specifically for me too. A lot of the dresses that the women were wearing, like they had those that shape. I don't know how women in the 1800s did this, but like they had that shape that comes down their torso, and then it looks like they got like a mini horseback there to like fluff out their backside.
If the Coen brothers think something is a little askew or weird historically, and they like to satirize it, and they make such a show of it.
Yes. And it looked amazing.
Steven Root's circular glasses.
Oh God.
Everything about Steven Root's character. He is my favorite thing in like pick any 50 movies this year. He's just my favorite. His every gesture, both his costumes. God, I loved him. I love that bank that he's in. Think about the production design coming up with that bank.
Yeah, just in the middle of nowhere, nothing for miles around.
It's like a lunchbox in the middle
just
of the prairie.
Down,
and it just says bank on it. It's so remote.
The lighting, too, I wanted to comment on, especially in the last piece of the anthology there. We're in this caravan ride, and it's going from like dusk, and as the conversation prolongs, we enter night. And we go from this golden background to like this dark blue shadowy background as the sun sets. I thought that was a really good job.
So yeah, it feels very Coen Brothers. It's on location, like New Mexico, the prairie in Nebraska. I will say, as we get into the next session, cinematography, there's a few off-looking shots and visual effects that bothered me just a tad.
Green screen stuff that I saw too.
Yeah, you can note it. You notice the touch-ups. I don't know what it was, but in terms of Oscar lens, production design 12th on award circuit, costume design 14th on award circuit.
I would just bump it up for costume design for Tin Daly for having to actually wear that ridiculous looking dress.
That's high neckline.
Yeah. Right? So I would bump that up to a top 10.
She's hysterical in that scene.
Yeah, she is. She's awesome.
Study her facial expressions.
She's awesome.
God, is she great in that. Cinematography is 7th on award circuit right now, Mike. That's one of the higher numbers. But I felt like, again, the Academy and award circuit, they're nominating the wrong things. Like, to me, the music to this is phenomenal. The screenplay is phenomenal. And the cinematography, there's some...
Yeah, well, either they are or we are, right? Because we see this the same
way. They are!
You're right. Screw you guys. No, I agree. The cinematography is beautiful in certain... And they get... My God, can they shoot lush countrysides and lush plains?
So... My thesis statement here, why do I keep writing thesis statements? But right now it is that the highs of the cinematography.
Right. Outshine what kind of stick out
like
there.
Like belong in a museum. Yeah. I mean, some of these shots are just all-timer Western greatness.
I would say the one with Tom Waits especially.
The
Liam Neeson one where it's going across a snowy plain.
The film critic voice. Somebody punch me in the face. You're right. That whole nature setup, that's a nature
I think it
porn.
Looks absolutely gorgeous. So I could see it. I don't think it's a top 10 of the year. I could see it, though. I won't begrudge.
The bluish hues of that final story.
We'll get till December when
me.
I start begrudging people. I think next month I'll start holding grudges
you
against...
You do hold those grudges, but it's still like top 10 or 15 in my cinematography. There's some off looks, especially in that first Buster Scruggs story.
Good job.
good. And but I dropped my jaw at other visuals. In terms of the rest of the production values, this is 38th on award circuit for film editing. We talked about the pacing already, an improvement on Hail Caesar, more in the line of Burn After Reading in No Country for Old Men, slow Coens.
Yeah, there's other films this year that we thought were tremendously upgraded due to their editing that aren't going to have a chance in this category. So that's probably about right. Top 40-ish seems to be fair, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, if it's going to line up with Best Picture, which is 27th on award circuit right now, it's probably not going to get nominated for editing.
But I said to you beforehand, this to me feels much more like a Best Picture contender than Widows. And I know we're in the minority for our Widows review, but we both stand by it.
As a composition, it's a good segue because Best Director, the directors are controlling the overall composition.
Sure.
This flows really well. We have six separate stories, and yet thematically they're joined together. We have these characters in terms of their tones, it's somewhat joined together, and each one really flows. There's a beginning, middle, and end to each. We don't have like major plot holes for this one.
Yeah,
and that was the whole Widows problem, just
all
gaping chasms.
Yeah,
of plot
it's pretty tightly written around all of these, so I don't know if that you want to credit screenplay or director, but it's the same guys doing both of those.
So I notice many more good things upon rewatch. I mean, there's little details that are just so good. And in the performances, because you got an all-time cast here, I mentioned them quickly, and I named some of my favorite work that they've done. But these are character actors or asters at the piece or the peak of their powers. I'm just going to have an if and or.
It's a choose your own adventure review.
For each statement that I make. There's heaviness to this plot line that they do a nice job with as well, because there's a lot of emotions going on that are induced from the audience.
Yeah, I would say absolutely. And just on the face of it, you're dealing with life or death in a couple circumstances as well.
Well, I've said it at the beginning. The Old West was a hard, sucky place. So let's get into the performances, Mike. Best supporting actor Tim Blake Nelson is 8th on award circuit right
now. I would love to see that. I would absolutely love to see him make his way into the top 5. I loved the Ballad of Buster Scruggs short.
He is so good in this, but Stephen Root! I want Stephen Root. I know he's in he's got 25 seconds of screen.
I was gonna say, he's got three lines of dialogue.
I realize that. It's some of the best, it's one of my favorite scenes all year.
All right.
Do a pick your favorite scene. I love that scene
The degree of difficulty from what Tim Blake Nelson has to pull off, though, with his dialogue compared to Stephen Root is...
You're not wrong.
Yeah, all right. I just want to make sure we're on the same page.
I've watched this movie in full 3 times.
Okay.
I've watched that scene about 7 times. And that's not a lie.
All right.
I keep rewinding it pretty much every time, and I rewinded it twice the last rewatch because I had people come into the room. They're like, wait, what just happened? That's hilarious. Oh, my God. Loved it. I've overhyped it so bad.
Yeah, you have, but that's okay.
It's 15 seconds of cinema,
yeah.
But it's one of my favorite things. Best Supporting Actress, Zoe Kazan, 35th on award circuit. She is very good. There's one scene where she's crinkling her eyes, acting happy, acting sad, acting bewildered,
she's
acting
doing
shocked.
A shitload with her face. Absolutely.
Another phenomenal scene.
Yeah, and she's, of course, the girl from The Big Sick last year. We were very high on then, too, as far as the Mike and Oscars went. We both had her quite up there.
But this is a showcase for a lot of talent. Liam Neeson not having a lot of dialogue, really showcasing his ability. And say what you want, James Franco's good in this.
Yeah.
I thought he's pretty good. I mean, he's dealing with a lot. I mean, he's stoic. He's a stoic jerk. And I'm going to have a lot of things to say about the theme of his story and how it mirrors real life. I think that's pretty fitting. But wonderful cast. Everybody on the wagon train at the end. Brendan Gleeson with the dead eyes. Why does he have dead eyes? They're dead, those eyes.
Well, I don't know if that was a particular choice or if it's just because of what he was playing, you know what I mean?
Right.
That he kind of shaded that way. But I think that last scene, I was just very impressed with how the ensemble worked out.
But you got Clancy Brown, again, in 15 seconds of screen time in that first Buster Scruggs, acting like the biggest jerk in any movie ever. And he was the jerk in Highlander, the villain there, and the villain in The Shawshank Redemption, or the main henchman.
Right.
We hate him from other movies. Is he ever been more hateable than when he wants to force Buster Scruggs to play that hand of cards? Again, these bit players... are just showing out throughout the script. And then obviously when you get a Tom Waits, when you get a Tim Blake Nelson, and they get to carry a whole story, Zoe Kazan, it works phenomenally.
Loved all the performances in this. Thought they were above and beyond what I could have expected.
So some final thoughts right now, Mike. I mean, this screenplay is wonderful. I love 4.5 out of 6 of the stories. And any, like I said, on first first watch,
pull the hair up by the roots.
This story swept me up. And the degree of difficulty for an anthology, 6 separate stories of different pacing to sweep me up and to sweep my brother Daniel up, who all he does is watch YouTube. And you are a YouTuber.
Yeah, I'm with you, man.
You're
it was way more enjoyable than I was expecting or I really had any right to be. I loved it. I really did. I have a high mark for it at the end of the day, and I think all 4 out of 6 of them for me too was pretty well enjoyable.
So something that just dawned on me, and my brother John texted me before, he's like, I watched this story and then that story. I'm 2 stories in. Do you think people will watch this piecemeal?
I have a question about that involves the last piece of it, so we'll talk about that. Maybe we could lead off with that in spoilers.
Okay, so that's a carryover. I wonder if the YouTube generation would take more to this story as an anthology. Maybe that's
or
the future of movies.
Yeah, could be.
Maybe that's the future of movies, Mike. Maybe we should write more anthologies.
We talk about how there's no attention span for anyone and everyone just wants what they want on demand now because they're so spoiled with it. So yeah, that could. Maybe the Coen brothers are ahead of the curve on this.
They're
maybe they're dipping their toe in.
They're in for 20 minutes here, 25 minutes there, 15 minutes here.
And presented in such an overly cinematic way, there's obviously room to pull this off.
For me, it's one of the best screenplays of the year. I forgot to give that was 7th on award circuit, major threats category.
Original screenplay is wide open this year, too. So and, that would not shock me at all. I could see this, something like 8th grade I keep harping about. But there's not a lot of contenders up there right now.
And our spoiler section coming up right now is going to basically break down the plot after we do some quick carryovers, because this is one of those stories that just sweeps me up, like I said, and I want to know why it does that. I want to break that down here.
Hey, speaking of breakdown, let's dance.
Spoilers ahead! This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Spoilers!
This is the spoilers section for the Mike, Mike, and Oscar Sprint profile review of The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the Netflix property from the Coen brothers that just came out live a couple days ago on November 16th. If you have not seen the movie yet, if you do not want to hear about the twists and turns and spoilers therein, this is a good place for you to hit pause, go back, listen to the first half, go watch the movie on Netflix. You don't even have to move off your couch, man. You can just hit play, get those 2 hours in, come back and hit play on us, and we'll pick it up from there for you. If you have seen the movie already, if you do not care about watching the movie first, or if you've been interested, so interested from our first half non-spoiler review that you need to know what happens, you're in the right spot, because it's all spoilers all the time here on out for The Ballad of Buster Scruggs in this OSP review brought to you by Mike, Mike, and Oscar. Mike, we said we wanted to have a carryover from the first session talking about the purpose of the anthology setup by the Coen brothers.
Right. And you asked me, do we think people will watch this in sections, piecemeal, one short story tonight, the next one, maybe 2 more tomorrow, whatever. And my brother did that, just texting us on our group, whatever, weird 3-man, 2 brothers and 1 friend text message.
Which I feel awful about, because I talk shit about the other one in a one-on-one conversation otherwise, but that's neither here nor there.
And we have, him telling us that's exactly what he's done. I wonder if the YouTube generation can take stories nowadays better in that bite-size way, if we're going to get more anthologies. Because this one works, and this one works on Netflix.
On the MMO Weekly on Monday, we were commenting on how that's pretty much what the generation is now in. And advertisers are still trying to figure out a way to grasp that YouTube culture. And why does YouTube work so well? Why are they getting millions of video views? Part of it has to be that, right? That there's short little bites of well-produced content that are easily digestible.
Dense and funny and surprising, and that's what you get here. These short stories really work. They pack a lot of great reversals. The Coens are putting on a writing clinic.
I absolutely agree. And like I kind of hinted at this in the non-spoiler, I'm surprised how well the feature film format lends itself to the short, bite-sized, digestible anthology series.
And to be fair, I watched this movie 3 times over the last 3 days, 4 days, and I've watched, well, 5 days, really. And how long has it been out?
Two weeks, 5 years. It doesn't
matter.
Last
Friday. Today's Monday?
The days have blurred together.
4 days.
We have watched so many things and talked about them.
I watched this 3 times in 4 days, and basically...
Merry Christmas.
Basically, I watched it straight through each time, so I did not pause it. I remember feeling a little fatigued when I hit kind of the same spots in this movie, the second and third watch, because I would have appreciated a pause, come back to it later,
get
ready.
2 hours and 12 minutes, 2 hours, 13 minutes, whatever it is, that's a tall ask to rewatch and rewatch.
But I felt the pull. I felt the pull to YouTube it.
You kept hammering through?
I felt the pull to pause it.
I see. So that you agree. You agree with the bite size, this might be the future of film thing.
I didn't pause it, but you're right. I think I agree because
gotcha.
I felt the pull.
I gotcha. Okay. Trying to not focus on the sexual nature of that comment. What I also wanted to comment on is kind of starting at the end here for the spoiler section. And
I can't believe that. That was a long...
Restarting. It's been a long...
It's been a long day.
The weeks just blend together.
I just said felt the pull a lot.
Yeah.
And I realize what that means now.
There you are. Welcome to the conversation. The ending of this is kind of this meta argument about characters in this covered wagon saying... We argue as to whether or not they are in purgatory, heading to hell, essentially. But there's the argument as to what are people? Are people just all the same like ferrets? Are they hale and frail? Are they upright or sinning? Are they dead or alive? And that's kind of this meta argument.
We just had 5 stories where the worst of humanity is on display with their greatest hope, right? You know, we have the Zoe Kazan's character.
Right.
As hopeful as it gets at a
Absolutely.
Certain point in that story, and then the worst happens.
Meets a terrible
and
demise,
that
suddenly.
The worst happens in each
one of these
yes. stories, and we're asking why, and then basically it's just like, it almost acts as a epilogue,
yeah.
and as a capstone, all these other things, and you can make it as a metaphor for the hereafter, for the purgatory heading into the next life, the next phase, Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit kind of deal, hell is other people, because they're arguing about the meaning of life.
Right, and I think that's the, in one sense, it's the natural fitting for the end of an anthology like this, in that this is the overarching metaphor for hell, or the end of life, the end of days, etc.
Yes.
In another sense, I wonder if they put what the dialogue specifically is in that hell scene to force you to want to go back and rewatch it from the start, viewing these characters from the lens of, are they acting like ferrets? Are they dead or alive already? Are they hale or frail? Et cetera, et cetera. Taking that argument and then rewatching the whole movie again.
It worked for me because I was still unsure if we were doing this today at like noon. And I rewatched this 3 times before
it did. It's been a long life for me.
It's been a long life, a long week. I wasn't sure if Mike wanted to do it or not. And I had already seen it 3 times. Just so happened. So yes, Mike, it worked on me to get me to rewatch this movie because it puts a whole new context. Text on it, and it gets you thinking. It also gets you thinking about the Coen brothers as their whole filmography. I just read an article about them being accused of being nihilists. We believe in nothing, Lebowski. You know, the guy in the pool. He's a nihilist.
Right.
Don't bother him. That must be exhausting. No, whatever. So it's
so
they're always being attacked for being nihilistic. Tarantino, them, this kind of modern era of director. And what do? With the last scene of a 25-year long project, they talk about the meaning of life and they argue about it in the last scene.
That's a really good point.
With 5 different characters.
That's a really good point. And I think accusing them of being nihilistic is just foolish, because it's so clear to me that they see joy and death as such
yeah.
a fine line. Humor and death, contentness and demise with such a fine line that's why all these characters are pretty much laughing at the end of before they're killed. You know, it's to me that's silly, but I get it. And I think that's a really good point that you just made.
Talk about meta jokes, Mike. There's worked in through each story, but also the last story is a meta joke on their whole career.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that actually plays very well, and I think that's a fascinating point that you make, and if that's them thumbing their nose at their critics, well then, bravo to them.
All right, so we're giddy right now because we like all that irony and meta-ness, so we kind of covered number six. Let's go through 1 through 5. 1 and 2, we're going to take a little longer. 3, 4, 5, we'll go a little faster. So The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Or Scruggs.
You were almost there. You almost had it.
Or Terrell Suggs. I was charmed and fully set up for an epic Western musical here. We have him breaking the fourth wall immediately as he is the lonesome gunslinger in white traveling across the canyons.
What a commentary.
Talking to the camera, Michael. Yes. Isn't that wonderful?
Who's the guy in white in every Western? He's the hero that rolls into town, right? Not this guy.
Like the Strangers opening voiceover narration in The Big Lebowski, he's almost arguing with no one.
Nobody, yep.
He is arguing with no one about what people think of him. I know I'm not a misanthrope. Look at my wanted poster. It says I'm a misanthrope. I don't hate my fellow man. I have this code. This code is about civilized society and how you need to be polite and blah, blah, blah. And that's all. I don't want people to cheat at cards and blah, blah, blah. And it's really great. So he lays down his Western gunslinger code.
Yes, yes.
And then he puts it into practice.
Yes, and immediately he has two stops on this trail. The first one, he stops at this hole-in-the-wall saloon where he's asking for a shot of whiskey. The bartender says, "We don't serve you whiskey," and he pans over to these ominous-looking baddies to his right and says, "What are they drinking?" Well, outlaws can drink whiskey.
Yeah, they're drinking whiskey.
So the outlaws to his right are drinking whiskey, and Buster Scruggs doesn't take too kindly to that classism-type deal.
So immediately, right then, he knows he's going to kill everybody in that place. So as much as he is like just a stickler, he's like Hannibal Lecter, he's a stickler for manners.
Yes.
As a villain. And we don't know he's the villain here. We think he's in the right because all these other guys look like a bunch of goons.
And that's he's in the all white. He's the classic Western hero.
And he immediately throws down fighting words. He throws down, he's like, "You need a better class of friends and you need to be a better class of person, you idiot." But he says it in a very polite way.
In a jovial way. He's wearing a smile the entire
fighting
time.
Fighting words. He deserves to die.
He's literally
riding
into town on a white horse. This is our prototypical protagonist than any other Western movie, but...
And talk about dramatic irony just overflows in this movie, but talk about him slapping his chest when he walks in there and that ghost of dust is left behind him.
I love that.
And think about it. He turns into a ghost by the end of this story. Yep. The foreshadowing.
Well, the foreshadowing's all over this, too. Oh, we'll get to the card game in a second.
Loved it so much. So Buster Scruggs basically kills everybody in there, and he shows off at the end of it, shooting a guy behind the back.
Yes.
So he's a sadistic fuck.
Yes.
Like, everybody loves him, like, as a character, I hear, but he is an evil, evil bastard.
Pure evil. Pure evil. He's like the righteous gun of whatever. So he moves on from there. He's done with this saloon. He goes to another saloon. He moseys on up to a card game. One man stands up, leaves the table. So there's three or four other men in the middle of a card game. Buster Scruggs says, "Hey, can I take his spot? Do you mind?"
They made him take his weapons off. He feels a little bit naked.
Yes, yes. He has to dump his gun at the door, walks up to the card game, asks to join. And the big bad guy
from The Highlander and The Shawshank Redemption is like, "You see him, you play him." And essentially, he has to play this already folded hand of cards because this bully sitting across from him is making him play this hand if he wants to sit down because he's a little twerp-looking guy.
Now, the hand, again, foreshadowing, is Dead Man Hand. Aces and eights. That's the dead man's hand. You can't do anything with that.
I didn't notice that.
Yes. So, again, we're getting all kinds of foreshadowing. That's not going to end well for our friend Buster here. But at the time, he doesn't take kindly to being told what to do by this ominous figure who threatens him with his gun, which is still on him. He didn't have to take his off.
You see him, you play him. And if and I don't. And the guy stands up, draws the gun on him, and he kind of talks his way out of it, distracts the guy a little bit. Next thing you know, now you have a circular table that looks a little longer than it should be. It's like an oval.
And it's made with separate wooden planks.
There's a plank in the middle of
it.
Or whatever, divider, whatever. And he steps on it. It hits the man's drawn gun back towards his face. He's got a finger on the trigger and he shoots himself in his own face. And he does it again and again.
Three times.
I couldn't believe it. I was so shocked. I laughed so hard the first time I seen
this. That
was
so cool.
I am an evil bastard.
How? But here's, we're not evil. That's because funny. We didn't All think right, of good. This. How do you think of that setup?
I don't know. It's genius.
it's so smart.
It is the most creative showdown. A gunfight I have ever seen in all Western history. And there's some of the best action of the year in this movie. And I'm just so shocked by that.
Yes. And so is everyone outraged at that a man had just been murdered essentially by the hand of Buster Scruggs?
No.
Yes, at first. But hey, just like every other Western musical we've seen in cinematic history, he goes right into song and everyone's on his side again.
And he sings a song that basically just talks shit about the guy he just killed. Surly Joe, you're a bastard, whatever. He just sings that whole song making fun of this guy he just killed. So he is an asshole, Buster Scruggs.
So the entire bar is singing with him against this
He's
guy
on
who
the
he
bar.
Just killed. His face is blown off. His dead body's laying in the middle of the bar.
Right.
Whole bar singing. And so Surly Joe's brother happens to walk in and finds his corpse and basically challenges Buster Scruggs to a shootout in the Old West. Because again, we're playing on all the old Western tropes through cinematic history.
In terms of setups and payoffs, I love this so much. We have the game of life or the game of death, this gunfight. We see the rules of the game. We know he plays by a code. We know he wants to follow rules as whatever, just living in the world. And this other player goes with the rules as well. Are you ready? Ready. Are you set? Set. Do you want to count? No. So now you know they're fair game to draw on each other. Buster Scruggs shoots off his trigger finger.
Shoots off the guy's trigger finger.
Shoots off the guy from like
a distance.
100 meters away. And then he shoots off all of his fingers.
One by one.
One by one. So the guy doesn't quit trying to grab the gun out of his holster with his offhand.
Yes.
While Buster's turning around and talking to the camera again. I shot 5 shots and
I only got 1 bullet left. I better not miss.
Takes out his mirror, just showing off like a jerk, the biggest jerk in the world. Turning around, pride goes before the fall. Turned the gun over his shoulder. Oh, I got to go to the other side because it's in reverse. I'm looking in a mirror and he shoots the guy in the chest perfectly and kills him.
Yes. So funny, so perfect, so everything. And so
he's about to sing another song.
Yes. Immediately after there, we have, again, the old trope of the bad guy.
The man in black.
The guy, black horse, black suit, black hat, riding into town. And he wants to challenge Buster Scruggs to a shootout.
Harmonica. And it stops Buster Scruggs in his tracks because it's a beautiful music. And the man rolls into town like him, right?
Yes.
And you think they're going to be friends, and it's actually unnerves Buster. It like takes him by surprise that the man's like, I heard. And this is the first guy. Everybody's talking shit about his past. Oh, you're the Texas twit? And you mean Texas tit? Oh, you're this? You're the twerp
this is
of the
first
work?
Guy to treat him with respect.
The first guy to treat him with respect also says, and I also know you're the man who's the man to beat in terms of guns.
Right.
Or whatever he says.
Great. Beautiful setup.
We're following the rules of the game. And the man in black asks Buster, as Buster's turning around, do you need a count? And Buster says, no, sir. Bang. Because you can free draw at that point.
The cinematography of this is great. We don't see Buster get shot. We see him, his eyes kind of go bewildered.
Yeah, he freezes.
He takes off his hat and he sees the hole in the back of his hat and then the hole in the front of his hat with a little blood on it. And then he holds up his mirror to himself.
Yeah, vice versa. But
I'm sorry. Okay, I got the vice versa. But he holds up a mirror to himself and sees the hole in his head.
So everything we just did works through. And this is going to foreshadow the later story with the girl, Zoe Kazan, getting shot in that same spot. And multiple people get shot in that spot. And, you know, I think the Hindu religion would have something to say about it. I loved it. And he that shit ain't good or whatever he says. He falls back and dies. Of course, the man in black has to sing from then on.
Yes.
We get When a Cowboy Trades His Spurs for Wings, that great song, which I'm surprised I like. I guess I'm old now. Ghost Buster Scruggs is a winged angel flying from his dead body, singing this song in harmony with the man in black.
Basically, I hope there is an afterlife for cowboys, yeah.
I loved it.
It was so beautiful, so poetic. We glide seamlessly. That ends the first chapter of this book. We go to chapter two, which is near Agandis, which is where we have this cowboy, James Franco, standing outside the aforementioned desolate bank in the middle of nowhere. And he goes in, and we meet the tellers, played by Stephen Root, the Have You Seen My Stapler guy from Office
There's
Space.
So many good little moments in that scene. Rewatch that as many times as I did. It is worth it, because he is just another one of those characters, again, foreshadowing a later character in the movie, that is so desperate for human connection, he just wants to talk to
anybody.
Franco comes in there and goes, "So your bank, huh?" or something like that. Something so
you
simple.
You ever been robbed before?
And Stephen Root, you ever been robbed before? And Stephen Root's like, "Yeah, I think I did this and one time." And it's hysterical because Franco can't listen to him anymore. Takes out the gun
mid conversation.
Stephen Root goes, "It's so funny because he's on such a roll." It's like when one of us is hard charging into the other's conversation.
Yes.
And we do it constantly.
Every
and
episode.
He just goes, and then he has to finish his story. And he goes, "And the Frenchman," or whatever he says. I'm rewatching that. It's just such a little note. Makes me laugh so much. And then, of course, he's got his hands up, Stephen Root. And he's like, "I got the bigger denominations down there.
Gotta get the big bills down
and
here."
And he nods, and he tilts his hands down, and he nods down. He's got those goofy glasses that are...
Huge Coke bottle glasses.
Yeah, Coke bottle absurd glasses. And he gets down there. Of course, he's playing James Franco for a fool. Shoots the shotgun through not one of the boards, but three of the boards. Franco's very nimble. He jumps up kind of onto
Able
the barrier.
Able to avoid the shots, yes.
He's gone. Root is gone. Franco takes the money, runs outside, past the well, gets his feet shot out from under him. I don't know if he got hit, but he falls down,
either, yeah.
Hides behind the well. Now we got a shootout. When Franco turns around, the pots and pans
oh
man
Stephen
is there.
Root has covered himself head to toe in like a washing board, a boiling pot on his head. He's covered with aluminum everywhere, just protecting himself. And he's charging at James Franco with a gun. And go,
and Franco shoots him once. Ding. Pan shot. Shoots him again. And of course, Root comes right up to him, swinging the back of a rifle like a baseball
Maybe
bat.
Maybe the single funniest 20 seconds in film this year.
I laughed so hard. The end of Sideways didn't make me laugh harder than this. I love this scene. It's my favorite scene in a long time in terms... I've watched a lot of movies this year. They're all playing together, but this I love. So Franco wakes up with Innocence Face, the deputy sheriff or whatever.
Yes.
He's getting hung. Any last words? And he's like, "Wait, what's my sentence?" And whatever. Finally, he's like, "All right, fine, hang me." Indians come, kill this posse.
Yes, Franco's facing the town law, essentially. He's hung up to a noose and on the back of a horse.
On the back of a
They're
horse.
Waiting for the horse to run away. Just as they're about to call the horse away, the Indians come. They basically attack all the cops that are there, and one of them gets right in Franco's face.
Now, this is crazy, because you keep worrying about this horse moving, and Franco, like, he's a protagonist. So, like Buster Scruggs before,
he is.
We're rooting for scoundrels, even though we don't realize it. Like, we should be rooting for Stephen Root. We should be rooting for the Man in Black. We should be rooting for the Avenging Brother.
They took every Western convention and just flipped it on its head, which was hysterical.
Loved it.
The cinematography in this as well. I mean, we had bullet time in The Matrix. This time we have arrow time. We see an arrow fly by James Franco's face and hit a cop riding off behind him.
When the guy pulls one arrow out of his neck, another one comes
right
in
through.
There.
Oh, it looked magnificent. So eventually,
the Indian chief gives him a stare down. You think he's going
to
kill him.
Yeah,
and
tries to scare the horse away.
Right.
Eventually, the Indians ride off. All the cops are dead, and Franco gets the attention of a herder off in the distance.
After a while, after this horse is grazing, getting a little further, and the minute detail and the focus of the camera on the next shrub, the next shrubbery, it's just so good.
Yes. And so he calls a herder off in the distance who does come, cut him down.
This is why I love the Coen brothers.
They start talking about their future together and another guy who won't shut up.
The best part about this is that this guy, I'm the guy who won't shut up now, is this cattle guy, this cattle driver, comes to him And instead of like cutting him down or something normal, he's trying to shoot him down. The first shot misses. The horse runs out from under him and he's like,
he's hanging there.
Franco,
stop moving.
Stop moving. And he finally shoots off the rope and Franco falls down safe. It's just freaking hysterical.
So we have another, the sheep herder again will not stop talking to Franco.
Desperately wants to be
how
friends.
How he needs, going
to
need a sidekick and maybe Franco would make a good sidekick. It's got to be someone you trust.
Need someone who knows something about sidekick and nobody knows anything.
Bam. They run right into the law again.
So this guy's not a cattle driver. He is a cattle rustler. So Franco is immediately imprisoned again. How about this for Western justice, Mike? This little trial that basically is like, well, that's enough. Hang him. Whatever that guy says, it's one of the funnier lines going.
Franco does have a funny line, I will admit. When he gets his bag off, he's now going to be hung in town square
with
the
like
middle
four
of a
other guys.
And you go
talk about macabre humor.
Next to him is freaking out, and Franco turns to him and goes, "Oh, your first time?" I thought that was funny.
It was funny, and now this is the part I want to ask you. Now Franco focuses on a pretty girl in blue, and he goes, "Oh, that's a pretty girl," and then gets the hood over his head and is hung.
Now, you think that's him saying his apology?
Is that an a James Franco apology? I mean, it seems too close to what's going on. He's a scoundrel.
It is rich
movie.
With subtext. I will agree.
His character is a scoundrel.
I only think that plays that way if he comes out and says it. I don't think you want a Coen Brothers subtext to be the official apology and the mea culpa of you know? It could very well be, but I think you want him to come out and say that for the people that aren't going to spend 2 hours watching the Buster Scruggs anthology movie is my only counterpoint.
True. But what a story here. So the next few we'll go through a little faster. Meal ticket, sad, mesmerizing on the first watch. A thespian with no arms or legs is basically performing order in this wagon. Liam Neeson is the caretaker and producer of the show in the wagon. They painstakingly
so fucked up.
They show these two travelers. They show Liam Neeson basically setting up the show. Setting up the stage for the
night.
It's
a one-man band,
performance.
Basically.
So it's a one-man performance. This orator, basically, he recites poetry. He recites the Gettysburg Address. He recites all these different dialogues, these classical dialogues. And the crowd at the end of the first one loves them. They get a full hat full of, they pass the hat. They get a full hat worth of thing. They have a nice dinner afterwards where, you know, Liam Neeson doesn't give them the piping hot beans. He gives them regular beans and they have a nice dinner and everybody's happy and they go on to the next show.
And there's cuts throughout all this where Liam Neeson is everything for this man. He has to hold him while he urinates. He has to hold him. He takes him with him when he goes to a whorehouse.
What a choice. There is not a single line of dialogue between those two.
No.
What a creative choice.
And I mean, how much more intimate can you get? What can you say dialogue-wise that's more intimately than holding up a man with no appendages as he relieves himself and urinates out in the forest? Like, there's nothing you could say that's going to create a bond stronger than you literally having this man to his only support.
Liam Neeson takes him into the whorehouse, turns him around. It's just absurd what happens here. I know it's a metaphor. But if you think about it in actual people terms, it is the scariest thing ever. And it's like,
what have you done for me lately?
What's
man?
The worst thing about the West? So this is a metaphor for modern show business.
Yes.
100,000%. And they go from town to town with less and less of an audience. And it's a big montage. And they mix in the whorehouse. They mix in the late night dinners where now Liam Neeson is feeding them piping hot beans instead of blowing on it first or instead of letting it cool. And basically he's taking less good care of the boy or the 20-something year old performer.
God, so well done.
Finally, after their worst show, only two people in the audience, nothing gets really passed into the hat. Liam Neeson comes upon another crowd. There is a chicken doing math.
A math doing
what's
18 chicken.
Minus 7? And the chicken dings the number 11 thing. However, they got this chicken to do
oh
this.
Oh my God.
No. Maybe this was like a thing back in the Old West, and they would like put like a little reverberation on the 11, and then the chicken would know to peck the thing. I don't know. But here we have this boy reciting Ozymandias and the Gettysburg Address for hours on end. This beautiful performance every single night, and a chicken that does math is bought by Liam Neeson, this producer.
Because it draws a crowd.
Now we have an awkward, and we have two people in the back of the wagon, or two performers.
A man with no appendages and a chicken who does math riding in a covered wagon through the cold winter months.
Oh, my God.
Liam Neeson in the driving snow pulls up to a river.
Looks around, drops a big rock into the river.
He walks over to the river, grabs a giant rock, and drops it into the river to see if it'll sink.
And it does.
It sucks. So all we see is the poet's perspective of Liam Neeson walking up to the back
and
of the
river. And he smiles.
Giant smile on his face.
Gross brown teeth. And next thing we know, it's just the chicken in the back of the wagon. Go for it. It's the sickest
story ever.
It's the worst.
It's so sick.
It is hysterical.
What have you done for me lately, man? That is, how beautifully
done.
If it
wasn't such an over-the-top metaphor, it would rip your heart in a thousand
pieces. Of course.
Okay.
A guy with no arms and no legs. Can't fend for himself.
Nightmare. Waking nightmare. All Gold Canyon is a beautiful story. You mentioned
Tom Waits was made. Tom Waits, whatever. Listen, he was made for this role. He was born to play this character. He is an old prospector that only works for himself, trying to find the gold mother lode. I imagine it's out in California somewhere. He was made the bad teeth, the raggedy clothes, the hardworking mentality, the goddamn you rascally squirrel.
Great character in this. He should get some Oscar, at least on lists. He should be on lists as best supporting actor.
I 100% agree.
You're right. He's terrific in here. And he's got some Oscar real scenes. He's talking to himself throughout this thing and talking to this.
And what a lonely life.
Mr. Pocket. I'm going to find you, Mr. Pocket. You pocket of gold. He's digging along the riverbed. It's a fascinating process, looking for more specks of the gold in the soil of the river. I had no idea this was how it worked, but
yeah,
it does.
Yeah, he's like triangulating the source of the gold flakes. It's really fascinating.
They're also showing him making like his breakfast, going to bed at night, again, talking about the prospecting to himself, and he steals an owl's egg. He could steal the whole nest of eggs, but he has a stare down with the owl from a tree across the way. He's climbed up pretty high in this tree. Either they're going to get into a tassel, or he only will take one egg. The owl allows him to take one egg. He gets permission.
Doesn't he take them all at first and then put all but one back?
Yeah. He takes them all at first. He puts one back. He gets permission from nature to take from it. Nature agrees, lets him take one egg for his breakfast. He does. So again, he is like the one with nature. He goes back down. He's getting closer to Mr. Pocket. He finds Mr. Pocket. Then he notices a shadow behind him. He finally cracked open.
He has found the source of the gold.
A rock with gold inside.
Found a gold mine, essentially. He's dug enough underground, and then he's staring at it, celebrating his victory. And he's down in the earth.
Sees a shadow
behind him. So he notices a shadow off the gold, so he knows someone's behind him. He looks to his pickaxe in case he's got a fight, and before he can turn around,
gets shot in the back.
The man is up there shooting him in the back.
Man has a cigarette. Man looks at the owl. Of course, we're all looking at this owl. Goes down into the hole. Tom Waits.
You can't kill Tom Waits!
Wakes up. They have a gun. They have a fight for the gun, a struggle for the gun. Waits wins. And Waits shoots him in the face through his hand.
Yes, again, gunshot. Nobody does gunshots like the Coens. Look beautiful.
Now, in a crazy Oscar reel scene, Tom Waits runs out of there screaming just on a soliloquy, Michael.
It went clean through! It didn't hit nothing important!
It's great.
Yeah, he's at the river trying to clean his wound. He's got a hole on either side of his torso. He's celebrating because he's happy. All he got was blubber.
Goes to bed that night, wakes up the next morning. He's breathing heavy. Is something going on with him? Nope. He gets a couple of bags full of gold, but I don't know. Maybe there's more, maybe there's not. He leaves with a couple of bags. We get a bookend of all the same nature shots that we saw. The minnows, the deer,
beautiful.
The owl, the breeze over the plains, in the valley. And it's just a wonderful. And if we get one.
How's that for a save your nature subtext? To only do as much damage as you need to.
Yeah, but we get one of these stories that actually ends happily.
Yeah.
The only one.
Yeah.
And we don't even know because Whitley died of his wounds.
Because he did like you said, nature allowed him so much. They allowed him an inch, and he didn't try to take a mile. He just wanted to disrupt it as much as he needed to. We don't even get the suggestion that he cleaned out the gold mine. Just two bags worth.
Yes.
You know, leave something for the next generation, I think was the kind of the message. I love that. And then we get probably what is our longest anthology piece called The Gal Who Got Rattled. This is the Zoe Kazan. She plays Alice. She's going with her brother Gilbert to Oregon to hopefully end up marrying this well-to-do man, but she's not sure it's actually a thing.
This is all at a dinner table. An old woman there is talking about the tendrils of the nervous system and how this man had
a picture in a book.
This man had a nervous cough, I tell you. Talking about a cough that the brother dies of the next day on the first day on the Oregon Trail. Now, there are two trail leaders, right? The two guides leading the entire wagon caravan together to get there. They help her bury the brother who has a dog that everybody complained about. Michael, this story would have broke my heart if they did not commit unforgivable sin of not embracing this dog and later trying to... you know, put this dog down just for barking. And the brother was 100% right when he had that little speech by dogs bark. He's my property and my property barks.
So there's, like you said, the two leaders, Mr. Knapp, played by Bill Heck, and the other one's Mr. Arthur. Mm-hmm. Zoe Kazan has the dog after the brother's passing, and he gives it to Knapp to try and put down. And Knapp goes over the hill. He's my dog, Mom. I'll do it. Like the old Yeller type thing goes over the hill.
And this is the dog Kazan, from The Artist.
Zoe Kazan can't even live with herself. She covers her ears so she doesn't hear the blast. And we hear three gunshots, which confuses her and confuses us, because why does it take three gunshots to kill this little puppy? And Knapp comes back and says, I put him down and he ran off. I don't think I hit him once.
Right.
So we feel a little relief, but you've already committed the unholy sin of trying to do away with a defenseless animal.
So she keeps asking more and more of Mr. Knapp. She asks him to bury his brother. The next day she's like, all right, we're a little out of sequence here, but she tells him that the man driving her carriage, her wagon, it was promised by the brother, and this seemed like a tall tale. $400.
Yes.
And Arthur's like, that's an exorbitant. That's a high
state
price.
State price.
That's a high price. Yeah. And essentially, this kid is going to leave unless she gets $400, but she can't find any money in the wagon. It was on the brother's person. When they buried him, they didn't leave any marker there because she didn't like her brother all that much. But also the guy tried to console her, and he's like, well, the Indians are going to scavenge it anyway if we leave a marker here, just to try and be Jesus nice Christ. About it. It was just the most, this is the most macabre story ever. So they've moved on. They can't go back and get the cash from the brother. So now Mr. Knapp, Billy Knapp, is like, I got a crazy idea. Let me think on it for a day, and tomorrow, just lead this guy along another day, this boy, this servant, and see if we can deal with it tomorrow. So that happens. There's the thing with the dog, like you said. And so it comes down to Billy Knapp asks Mr. Arthur, I think I'm going to ask this girl to marry me. Because they had a nice conversation, and she's a polite.
But that's how it was back then, I guess. We've had a nice
conversation. Yeah. Let's get married. The 1920s movie.
Too many guys think that way still.
So Billy's plan is to quit the wagon train business, marry Alice, settle in Oregon, get a grant. Yeah, he figures
he's shit or get off the pod age. Either I'm going to do this forever, walking this trail with Mr. Arthur, or it's time for me to settle down and have a family.
Michael, that proposal scene is terrific.
Zoe Kazan is terrific. Oh, God. Her face.
They both were great, but yes, she is
her
awesome.
Face is going all over. She's bewildered. She's excited. Like, oh, she's nervous.
Oh,
right.
And then she crinkles her eyes, and she's actually happy and crazy sad and as nervous as I've ever seen a human being.
Yeah, she plays that character so, and it's amazing too that it's the same actress from The Big Sick who had to be so strong and resolved.
So despite the fact that they wanted to kill this little doggy, I'm rooting for them again. Now they go back and forth. They go back and forth about the young man who's helping her as a cattle driver, blah, 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 or a wagon driver. And essentially it comes down to this. She finds the dog and she reunites with the dog. She's on a horse away from the wagon trail.
Yes.
She went off on her own. And Mr. Arthur finds her.
Which was a problem previously already. We had established this is after she kind of already has a history of wandering
after
away from
the trail. She accepts, of course, the marriage.
Right. The next morning she had said, yes, I'm inclined to accept your offer. So yeah, let's get married. But first, let's get to Oregon. So yes, she's on her own. Mr. Arthur catches up with her and the dog.
An Indian shows up in the distance. Yes. Now, we know they're scavengers, and Mr. Arthur's freaking hell out. Takes a saddle.
Well, he's excited. He knows there's a battle coming.
He finally perks up.
Yeah.
The whole rest of the movie, Mr. Knapp is asking him these big, long questions. Like, buddy, we've been working together for 15 years.
Give me something.
Should I marry this girl? And he's like, eh.
Yeah.
Throw me some jerky.
There's a pack of Indians coming. And he's like, oh, we're about to have a battle.
And he's the most eloquent.
He's ready to go.
Orator. He's talking her down. He is a hostage negotiator. Gives the Indian the peace sign. Doesn't happen. Basically makes a makeshift little shelter or whatever, ridge or whatever. Puts a saddle on the ground on a little prairie dog thing. Because we just saw the dog barking at the prairie dogs, yes. Which is how Alice found them, right? Yes. Prairie holes everywhere. The Indians come en masse. There's like 20 or 30 of them.
And he does a good job of holding them off, Mr.
And he's
Arthur
like, I got to kill the chief. If I kill the chief, I'll win. Dog hole. They keep running into the dog
holes.
Just like pan shot. You know, again,
Their horses
bookends.
Keep hitting these prairie dog holes, so the horses basically do the job for him. So he's using both the lay of the land and his own artillery to keep these Indians at bay, and he's doing quite a good job until finally one catches up with him.
So at the beginning of this fight, he told her, he's like, listen, this gun, he gives her a handgun, it's got two bullets in it, one for you, one for me. These Indians will do terrible things to us if they capture us alive. So if you see I'm licked, shoot me and then yourself. If you see that I die, shoot yourself. You know, if I'm helpless, shoot me and then her, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, no, I can't do it. He convinces her. And he's talking to her throughout the scene. And it's great coaching. And he's giving you the play-by-play of what's going on. He's calling them out. He's like, I'm going to take it. I'm going to fight you this way. I'm one man with a rifle. This is how I'm going to fight 20 people charging at me. And he does. And it's a great action scene. And now he's finally got a stare down with the chief. The chief knows it. He knows it. They both know they have to. Who's going to shoot first? It's a game of chicken. He's not even hiding behind the saddle anymore. He's standing up in the middle of the prairie. All these Indians charging at him. They both have a prolonged stare down. Right when he's about to shoot, the chief hits the dog hole. And tumbles over, breaks his neck, whatever. Now all the Indians scatter. There's only horses, naked horses, running around of the Indians who got shot off. One has an Indian hiding perfectly, side saddle, comes up, hits him with a club.
Straight out of Romeo and Juliet now.
About to scalp him. He is playing possum, I guess, or he wakes up at the most fortuitous time ever. Shoots the Indian in the head with his handgun.
Yes.
And he gets up. He's saved. All the other Indians are gone. The dog is
barking.
And all
we hear is the dog barking.
At the mound, he goes back. Oh, you shouldn't have done it, miss. She shot herself in the head. He showed her right where to shoot herself if she needed to make sure it got done right.
Straight out of Romeo and Juliet.
And it's the same spot that Buster Scruggs got hit.
Oh, it was
right
beautiful.
In the temple.
It was so sad. It was... And this is sad because the woman was making it on her own. She she admitted she felt free that her brother was dead. And he brought on her anxiety, and she felt that weight lifted off her.
She reunited with the dog.
Yeah, she's ready to make her own decisions, her own life for herself. She's got her dog back, and nope.
We're rooting for her and Billy Knapp at this point because they have a oh shucks charming,
exactly,
little insane, but you know, good relationship. She has no family. We empathize with her and sympathize with her so much. And with Billy Knapp, because all he's got is the grumbling Mr. Arthur, who we didn't know was a superhero. He is William Money times two. It was one of the best action scenes in a while.
It was awesome.
Terrific.
This is one of the best action movies of the year.
It's awesome.
Which is insane because there's like four separate scenes of action.
Pan shot, dog hole. It's great stuff. And it's funny and it's great. Anyway, we get into the mortal remains, which you already talked about.
Which is where we started. So, yes, as a means of just wrapping up here, Mike, what was your 6-1, just quickly, ranking these sections here?
It is tough, because I actually talked myself into liking the number 4, the gal who got rattled, a little more.
I did, too.
I love the first two a lot, and I think the Franco one is my favorite by a smidge, even though I love Buster Scruggs. And then the third one was the old prospector. What was that one called?
All Gold Canyon.
But I think I'm going to put...
The Gal Who Got Rattled?
The Gal Who Got Rattled just above it because of that great scene. And then All Gold Canyon. And I like the end scene. And then Ozymandias, the meal ticket, is my last, even though it is the most evil joke that works.
That's why I put it higher, because I'm a sick individual, and that made me laugh.
It was mesmerizing.
I couldn't believe it. You're having sex with the guy's back turned, first of all.
Oh,
and then when you're done with I was near Algantes just out of principle. James Franco, I still have a problem with him, but yeah, obviously high comedy, but that's my number six. These are all worthwhile. I know I said four at the beginning, but now that we went over them, I'm excited for all of them. The Gal Who Got Rattled, I was probably lowest on, but you're right. You did a lot in selling that, as a matter of fact, and I would highly suggest people listen to your retelling of it before they actually see it, because it will spoil it, but nonetheless, you did a great job of selling it. Four meal ticket for me, three All Gold Canyon, two The Mortal Remains, and one was Buster Scruggs. And I got me doing it. Scruggs for me.
It's a hard word to say.
Yes, it's not easy. Be spitty.
Buster Scruggs is a great ending. It's my favorite song in a Coen Brothers movie in a while. I like the last one, I think, because I like to think about the last one the most.
And well, yeah, there's a lot, most meat on the bone, I think.
Some of these are hard to watch, though. So again, you know, we said it in non-spoiler. You know, this I can't force people to watch this necessarily, because it's heavy.
It is.
We mentioned that early on. But as anthology movies go, this is one of the better in recent memory. Coen Brothers at the peak of their powers. It's a writing clinic for setups and payoffs. Those are my final thoughts, Michael. Yours?
My final thought is probably going to be my grade. I'll give it a hard 87, B plus.
Yeah, I'm at 89 B plus right now.
There you go.
High grade for me. It fits. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so worth checking out, but one of those, again, temper your expectations, got to be in the right headspace. We want to know your thoughts for sure about a movie like this, as interesting as it was. Not your typical Oscars movie. Do you think we're going to hear it announced come Oscar Sunday? Will it fit any categories, and what categories do you think? You can reach out to us, Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on the Twitter machine, Mike and Oscar at gmail.com, and on Reddit. We are available pretty much everywhere you listen to whatever these are called now, podcasts.
You got that spiel down pat.
It's been a long couple of days.
You are basically the meal ticket. You're my meal ticket.
Just, yeah, so if you could just dump me in a river, that would be great. Mike, any final words of wisdom here?
There's always a faster gun.
That is for sure. Yes. That is for sure. Guys, reality sucks. Keep watching movies with us. We'll check you out next time.
See ya.
Unsaddle my pony, she'll be itching to roam. I'll be halfway to heaven under horsepower of my own. Yippee-ki-yay.